Why has a family member of one of the 9/11 victims gotten a positive response to his 3-year-old application to launch a new inquiry into the death of his loved one? Is there any hope of breaking the official story of 9/11? Why did the 9/11 Commission, supposedly set up as an attempt to get to the bottom of what happened, answer only a small percentage of questions by family members? Why have even family members who doubt the official story of 9/11 been subjected to ridicule by some members of the public? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we do our anniversary special on the 9/11 attacks by seeing it through the lens of family members of the casualties of the terrorist attacks, particularly those who came to doubt everything that was said about the tragedy being caused by members of government for reasons other than being caught with their pants down. In our first half hour, Matt Campbell, brother of 9/11 victim Jeff Campbell, returns to the show to talk about the steps ahead for him now that his application for a new inquest into Jeff's death was refused. Then in our second half hour, we are joined by Ray McGinnis. He will talk about his 3-year-old book, Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. On this week's program, 9/11 Inquiry Denied and 9/11 Questions Ignored, conversations with Matt Campbell and Ray McGinnis. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 6th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download to the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We share this land and its resources, but should be aware that the colonizing people benefited from using broken treaties and false promises and should work toward reversing the trend that has subjected Indigenous peoples to colonialism and genocidal policies. We strive to balance such wrongs and work together as partners and as brothers and sisters with mutual respect. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The next step is not to stop requiring so many foolish vaccines. No, the next step must be, if we want to end this nightmare, to seize the assets not only of the corporations that promoted these actions, but of the billionaires hiding offshore or behind trusts and funds who pushed for this war on humanity. Moreover, all the classified documents hidden by non-disclosure agreements between corporations, governments, international organizations, and individuals must be made public without exception so that everyone will know what happened and the responsibility, moral and financial, can be traced by anyone with ease. The moral, legal, and constitutional basis for such action is self-evident. There is no other stance possible, and the sooner people grasp this reality, the sooner we can bring an end to this nightmare. That comes from the article, The Great Unraveling of the COVID-19 Global Psychological Operation, by Emmanuel Pastriche, posted September 5th, originally published on Fear No Evil. Instead of acting as an alternative to ground wars involving U.S. forces, U.S. proxy wars have spawned ever-escalating crises that are now making U.S. wars with Iran and Russia increasingly likely. Neither the changes to U.S. military training since the Second World War nor the current U.S. strategy of proxy war have resolved the age-old contradiction that Slam Marshall described in Men Against Fire between killing in war and our natural respect for human life. We have come full circle, back to this same historic crossroads where we must once again make the fateful, unambiguous choice between the path of war and the path of peace. If we choose war or allow our readers and their foreign friends to choose it for us, we must be ready, as military experts tell us, to once more send tens of thousands of young Americans to their deaths, while also risking escalation to a nuclear war that would kill us all. If we truly choose peace, we must actively resist our political leaders' schemes to repeatedly manipulate us into war. It comes from the article, Who Wants to Kill and Die for the American Empire? By Nicholas J.S. Davies, posted September 5th. The same kind of people that does not dare to speak up for their rights, then by Hitler's threats, today have been silenced by the COVID crime executed by their government, and they know, or think they know, contradicting the official government narrative would be worse, could be deadly. They suffer from more than cognitive dissonance, it is cognitive fear. They watch, four generations back, injustice galore, and hope it will not catch up with them. Let us pray and do whatever we can for Reiner Fulmick, that a universal justice will prevail, that eventually the sun's light will outshine Germany's and the Western world's tyranny in general. Justice must prevail. That comes from the article, The Case of Reiner Fulmick is Representative for a New Nazi Germany, by Peter Koenig, posted September 5th. The sturdiness of Telegram's encryption system is reflected by the fact that the armed forces of both Russia and NATO's puppet, Ukraine, regularly do their secret messaging through Durov's company. Durov and his brother have built up Telegram's ramparts against all sorts of spyware, but especially the invasions on databases facilitated by so-called backdoors, the digital nuke of internet integrity. One of Durov's supposed crimes is to have stood up to the security state's most aggressive thugs in denying them backdoor access to Telegram. All the other major platforms, including that of the Israeli government's servile puppet, Elon Musk, have by now handed over the security keys to the likes of Mossad, CIA, MI6, the FBI, the U.S. Department of Justice, and a host of other internet predators, public and private. Durov, however, is the main holdout. It comes from the article, Pavel Durov is an, quote, internet freedom fighter, unquote, by Professor Anthony J. Hall, posted September 5th, originally published on Looking Out at the World from Canada. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. People who listened to the show back in 2021 may remember the voice of Matt Campbell, the older brother of Jeff Campbell. Jeff was a British citizen attending a Rick Waters conference on the 106th floor of the World Trade Center's North Tower during the attack on September 11th, 2001. Matt has been actively researching 9/11 since November of 2001 and campaigning for justice for his brother by putting pressure on authorities, both in the US and the UK. When we spoke, he had just submitted a 2,500-page application under the UK Coroner's Act of 1988 to the Attorney General for England and Wales, requesting a new inquest into Jeff's death. Matt currently serves on the 9/11 Community Advisory Committee for the International Center for 9/11 Justice.
headed by Ted Walter. And Matt joins us now to talk about the results of his efforts to present evidence in a UK court that controlled demolition was the actual cause of his brother's death, not damage from a plane crash, resulting fires, and then the collapsing building, which is the official story. So, Matt Campbell, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, what decision did the Attorney General make regarding your application for a new inquiry?
Yeah, so we applied 3 years ago. And, you know, we expected to hear back, you know, within a year, certainly. 22 months later, so we're bringing it forward now to June 2023, we had basically a refusal obviously based on our application. We think it was based on our application. It looked like they hadn't read it. They refused permission. We wanted to challenge that, and there's a mechanism to challenge a decision made by an authority. Obviously, in this case, it is the Attorney General's office. And we challenged that. Well, we were going to take it to court, but we basically kind of, our barrister produced a summary of grounds as to why we would go and challenge their decision that they made in June, which we felt was unlawful and irrational. And they actually backed down. They realised that, you know, the decision they'd made had no, you know, merit at all. And so, you know, within their rights, they were able to go away and make another decision. So we waited another 4 months, so we're now up to January 2024, you know, still hopeful that they would see the light and, you know, do the right thing. And they came back again with another refusal. So again, we went through a process which is called judicial review, whereby, you know, it's what we threatened to do in September last year. But this time we've actually followed through with it. So we have we filed initial grounds and a kind of just a summary, a statement of facts as to why their decision was unlawful back in early April this year. And actually, oddly enough, as we're doing this interview now, we're going to file the remainder of that application to the High Court this week. So essentially what we're doing is we've taken all our arguments against why their decision is unlawful. I mean, it's so ludicrous, really, because we shouldn't be in this position fighting. You know, we can prove all day long that they did practically zero investigation into what caused my brother caused his death, which by law they're supposed to do in an inquest in the UK.
What did they actually state in the argument that you looked at, say, wait a second, that doesn't make sense, or that's wrong, or something like that?
Well, I mean, they essentially you know, just said the official narrative in the conclusion, and yeah, essentially I think you mentioned at the start, you know, they basically said that AA11 struck the North Tower, and, you know, it caused the tower's subsequent collapse. Now, that specifically is what we're arguing against, that there should be a new investigation because, or new inquest rather, because there is all this evidence of the use of explosives, controlled demolition, etc. But I said, even before we get to that point, you know, some of the grounds to get a new inquest reopened is if there is an insufficiency of inquiry. They did nothing. I mean, literally nothing. I mean, it was a real, you know, rubber stamp job, cut and paste from parts of the 9/11 Commission report. And that was it. I mean, by law, they're supposed to at least attempt to find out what caused my brother's death. And then, like I said, there's obviously all this new evidence which wasn't put in front of the coroner back in the original inquest in 2013. And so, you know, we were confident that the Attorney General, certainly the second time round, would see sense, and you know, because they can't really argue against our application. It's so strong, you know, in terms of no inquiry initially and all this new evidence. It should have been straightforward. Obviously,
what was that actually like? You got a 2,500-page document. I mean, what were some examples of some of the points that were putting forward that they, like, apparently hadn't even read?
I mean, it's nothing really that isn't already in the public domain. So, that is, the physics that you can see where you've got constant acceleration of the North Tower for the first 4 seconds. There's evidence of incendiaries, in the dust, etc. And there's we have a lot of statements from first responders who are witnesses to either explosions or flashes of light, etc. So I mean, the application itself, it was well above what you'd normally expect in order to persuade an attorney general to grant permission. So anyway, so back to where we are today, we have filed. We're going to finish the filing this week, and then this is where in theory things will move a lot faster. By law, they have 21 days to respond to our application to the High Court, and it's essentially there's probably about 60 key pages. But that's supported by now 7,500 pages. Now that's a mixture of precedents in law as well as evidence supporting our application. Again, it's extremely compelling. But this is, we're hoping that the Attorney General takes this opportunity, A, because there's been a change of government. We now have a Labour government in charge, so we've got a brand new Attorney General. We have a brand new Solicitor General. To some extent, we're hoping that they go, okay, our predecessors have made a really bad error of judgment here for whatever reason. We should do the right thing and let the family have a new inquest into Jeff's death. So that's what we're hopeful for. And so, like I said, we're filing this week, so just before the anniversary, and we've got 21 days. So in theory, by the end of September, we will know which path the Attorney General wants to take. And that's either do they want to continue fighting us, or will they actually capitulate and grant our wish, which is quash the original inquest and grant a new one. So that's, so it's going to be a bit of a waiting game for the rest of September.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering how long it's going to go on, or if there isn't a sense that it's like trying to put a square peg into a round hole or something like that. I mean, you go into detail about the flaws in the assessment, and I guess the NA, you maybe stated the NIST report was not valid because of this and this and this is spelled out by, well, like everything you were saying, and the several thousand architects and engineers were on board as well, but they counter by saying that an official authority says that it did not collapse due to controlled demolition, and the authority is the NIST. So there are the argument is flawed. I mean, is it something like that? Like you're just trying to argue with a brick wall?
No, I mean, we can make very strong arguments. Sorry, we have made strong arguments in law. I mean, the crazy thing about them, the Attorney General coming back saying that they rely on the NIST report, it's irrelevant. That was not put in front of the coroner at the first inquest, and certainly doesn't address any of the evidence that we've put forward that needs to be part of a, full and complete inquiry into my brother's death, which is what an inquest is supposed to be about. Yeah, I mean, dragging this on, I mean, unfortunately, that is the way that I guess lawfare works. They're exhausting you emotionally, time-wise, and obviously, more importantly, financially. And I'm very lucky at the moment, or that basically, thousands of people were helped with this action, because legal action, particularly this judicial review, because it isn't cheap. Barristers in the UK, do charge a fair bit, but it's a very specialised area of law, so it's really important to get the right representation. So, like I said, we're hopeful that the new change of government, a fresh pair of eyes, etc., is going to actually result in them acting in our favour, which is to capitulate and not go down the legal route. I mean, I think the last thing really, for a government to have, particularly with a case like 9/11, is A, to piss off family members, where clearly they haven't been able to make any coherent argument at all. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing the way that they've said no twice. If I worked for that department, a couple of very terse, short paragraphs that don't address any of the arguments that we've made, the evidence that we put forward, etc. And and they have a duty in law to consider our application and respond appropriately, and they haven't done that at all.
Okay, so I guess you're hopeful, in other words, because basically it's the sense is that, well, we're going to just take you, you're going to take the long path, the long, tedious path, where maybe they'll wear out, as opposed to, just trying to block it. I mean, they'll take every measure, but if you hang in there, you're going to get to your destination. Is that kind of what you're hopeful for?
Yeah, I mean, I have no choice. I mean, I'm going to carry on fighting this and take it as far as I can. It's one of those things. It's just so frustrating because on paper, this should have been a straightforward decision 3 years ago. If it wasn't anything to do with 9/11, if it was, someone dying in unpleasant circumstances, but nothing of a global scale, and all the questions that surround the events of 9/11, it would have been straightforward, I'm sure. But to be in this situation now, 3 years on, not even, we're not even in the coroner's court having a new inquest. We're actually fighting through the legal system to actually have, to get that new inquest. It's not certainly not a position I thought we'd be in 3 years ago. So I've got no choice, and I will continue fighting. And I said, I just hope that they cut it short and just get throw the towel in the next 21 days. Would be the best outcome that I can see.
A whole generation after your brother's death has gone by, and I guess you get the sense now that 9/11 is a successful attack by outside terrorists due to planes not controlled demolition, that this is the official narrative, and that you really can't break through no matter what brilliant work you put on the table. It's like, with, I mean, the similar questions have been raised with regard to assassinations, JFK, RFK, for example, that in the mind frame of a society, this is the truth. And it's going to be very difficult to break through after, not just 3 years, but 20 years of this being pounded into your heads. Is that something that makes you think, well, okay, maybe I have to shift my thinking in any way, or change tactics? Because I mean, there are other cases happening in the United States as well. I believe me, they have Mick Harrison is working with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth to try to bring facts to the table, and I don't know. It doesn't seem as if much is happening, but what we
Yeah, I
do.
mean, it's slow, but I mean, that is the way, certainly, in the UK, the justice system seems to work. I mean, we're 23 years on. I take great encouragement from two high profile cases in the UK, Bloody Sunday being one of them. That was back in 1972. That was still going through the courts, as recently as a few years ago. We had the Hillsborough disaster. And again, after 25 years, the family had some sort of semblance of justice. But more importantly, and I always stress this, for me, it's getting the truth. I've never really wanted retribution. I've been to the pre-trial down at Guantanamo Bay for the detainees there. I don't want the death penalty. I don't want to see anyone, more people killed. But I want to know the truth. And so that, along with the Saudi lawsuits, to me, are all part of trying to expose the truth. And in some small way, I guess, or a big way, depending on your take on it. That's what I'm trying to do with my brother's inquest. So, I mean, the passage of time is frustrating. Yeah, it's 23 years now, but it doesn't make me feel like we can't succeed, because, like I've just cited those two cases, they were both in excess of 25 years before, I guess the hard line that the governments took softened. And so, in some respects, because of the passage of time, that's why I'm more hopeful. And I say, refer to those two cases, both at Guantanamo and the Saudi lawsuits. Stuff has been unearthed and has come forward over the years that is very much at odds at what the official narrative was first presented at, which, as you pointed out, most people still have in their minds. No one really talked about, Saudi funding, Saudi providing material support, for example. That to me is some sort of progress towards shining more light on the truth. It may only be a small part of it, but that to me is important. And likewise, what we're trying to do here is another part of just trying to expose the truth of what happened that day. Obviously very personally with what happened to my brother. And obviously in theory, well, in theory, it applies to everyone else, certainly in the North Tower, but obviously both towers, really.
In the last couple of minutes we have left, could you tell me a little bit about the man you lost, Jeff? I mean, what was he like? Did he have a sense of humor, a girlfriend? Was he good at math like his brother? Tell
Oh,
us
God, he.
about a man that you and the world will never see again.
Yeah, I mean, he was very, very funny. He was very generous, had a huge network of friends. He was very bright. Everything was easy for him, just sailing through school, did a degree in economics and then did a master's. And almost everything he turned his hand at, he ended up being good at. He played chess against my little brother, Rob, who ended up playing for England in his sort of early teens. But Jeff could still have a very hold a very, very good game against him. And they'd often play sort of 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning after a night out, just at the end of an evening trying to play chess, trying to beat each other. And yeah, he'd just gotten engaged. And it's just, he was 31. Your life's just starting to get properly exciting at that age. You found your rhythm in life and stuff, and we all miss him. He was a key person in our family, really held us all together, and we all miss him. This action's not going to bring him back, but like I said, for me, to heal, we need to know the truth. I just, that for me is so important. So
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, thank you very much. Do you have a crowdfunder or some other ways of if people listening want to assist your case, or getting, helping to get this, can keep it moved forward, even though it's kind of dragging down on your own financial resources?
Well, I mean, at the moment we have the funds to fund this phase with the barrister. So it really depends on where we go in 21 days from here. A person or an organization that gives me a lot of support is the International Center of 9/11 Justice. So IC911.org. I know they have a donation thing there. Anything there would help because Ted spends an awful lot of time. He's been key, with this application, both the year and a half prior to us actually submitting, and he's been working alongside us all this time. But yeah, it's really our path will be decided in end of September which way this is going. But the best way of staying on top of the news is IC911.org or on X Matt Campbell 911. You can follow my practice. I'm not great with social media, but you can find the odd update on my post there.
Okay, well, Matt, let me once again say that I share your grief about what happened to your brother, and I hope you are more successful in your next, steps. I feel like I understand, and I know that you couldn't live with yourself if you didn't at least give it a try. So I thank you for being our guest, and yeah, we really appreciate it. And good luck. I wish you well.
Cheers. Thank you, Michael.
Matt Campbell is one of thousands of family members of the victims of the 9/11 attacks, and he spoke to us from Great Britain.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
The 9/11 families, relatives of those who died in the infamous September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, were the driving force behind a 9/11 commission to investigate the most brutal terrorist assault in American history. The 9/11 commission report was widely reviewed, but few people are aware of just how far the 9/11 commission report went to not only not answer questions. questions, but deliberately disrupt any evidence pointing to people's responsibilities within their own government. Well, we have this with us in the studio via Zoom, an individual, a Vancouverite, actually, who wrote about what the 9/11 Commission failed to uncover. And we'll let the viewers decide whether it is as definitive an investigation as it is reputed to be. The author's name is Ray McGinnis. He is a graduate of the Center for Christian Studies with a BA from the University of Toronto. McGinnis worked as an educator in the United Church of Canada for 18 years. For 2 decades, he taught journal writing, poetry, and memoir at writing workshops at churches, healthcare settings, grief support groups, professional development events, and retreats across North America. During the Freedom Convoy, he began to write commentaries about the government and media depiction of the protests and the invocation of the Emergencies Act. He's the author of Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored in 2021, and Writing the Sacred, A Psalm-Inspired Path to Appreciating and Writing Sacred Poetry. That's in 2005. So today, close as we are to the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, we're going to explore the events to get at the heart of the 9/11 Commission hearings about why vital pieces of information were left out. Ray McGinnis, it is a delight having you on the program. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael. Good to be speaking with you.
Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about your, to add to your biography before we delve into the unanswered questions?
I think that's pretty good. You know, I mean, I like cooking. I enjoy Thai food. You know, whatever else I could say. But I do want to say at the outset for your listeners that my book is not a book about the big tent of all the people who might fall under the rubric of the 9/11 truth movement. My book is about the questions that the family members who lost loved ones, who gathered together, asked officially the 9/11 Commission to, you know, to investigate and to find out whatever they needed to do to make the nation safe. And so I have a parameter around what my book was about in terms of the questions the family specifically asked, notwithstanding whatever questions they might have asked if they'd learned other things in the years afterwards. So it's a framework within which I ask questions, beyond which other people ask other questions that don't fit within the context of what I was trying to get at.
Well, could you just say briefly why you devised that particular framework of focusing on the unanswered questions by family members versus, say, you know, theories about what actually happened as other 9/11 truth books, such as, you know, the David Ray Griffin books did?
Yeah. So what, when I mean, you know, when I was asking, you know, when I would think about, you know, when people would bring up the shocking events of September 11th in conversation, if I would mention sometimes that I was aware that some people like David Ray Griffin or John Cobb Jr. or other people were asking questions, there would be an objection quickly presented, which was that it was disrespectful to ask any questions about the official story, according to the George W. Bush administration, because of the grieving families. And so I thought, well, did the families ask any questions? And if they did, what were they? And so I happened upon a book in 2007 by Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband Ron died in the South Tower, called Wake Up Call, the Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. And I found out, in my case, for the first time after 6 years since the attacks, that there had been not only families that were grieving and had questions, but they had gone to lobby Congress and the Senate and get John McCain and Joe Lieberman and others to pressure the administration to have an investigation. And had it not been for the families, there would never have been a 9/11 commission at all. So I stuck with looking at, considering just a dozen questions in my book of the over 1,000 questions the families wanted asked by the 9/11 Commission, who thanked the families when they first received the question, saying, like Timothy Romer, who was on the 9/11 commission, said to the press, "These are darn good questions, and we're going to get to the bottom of it." By the end of the whole investigation, when they came up with their report in summer of 2004, only 9% of the questions had been asked seriously, another 20% briefly referred to, and 70% ignored entirely. So I thought that was an interesting story to look at, regardless of what else, where other directions people can go, and just, you know, think, well, isn't that interesting what the families tried to do, and they got treated to stonewalling and being ignored in the great scheme of things.
You mentioned Kristen Breitweiser and Tiffany Romer. Could you maybe mention some of the other major players in the battle to get an investigation underway?
Sure. So there are people like Patty Casaza, who is a nursing student whose husband died in the North Tower. She had young children. Mindy Kleinberg's husband, Alan, died in the North Tower as well. She had young children. Lori Van Auken's a bit older and had her husband, Kenneth Van Auken, died in the North Tower. Monica Gabrielle had her husband, Richard, die in the South Tower. Sally Reagan-Hard had her probationary firefighter son, Christian, die at the World Trade Center. Carrie Lemack had her mother, Judy LaRocque, was in one of the planes that flew into the towers. And so these dozen people who spearheaded going to Washington, D.C., to knock on the doors of all the members of Senate and Congress and sit down in those offices and generate support for an investigation, not all 12 of the people who represented tens of thousands of families in this effort were asked by the press, "How did you vote in the year 2000? But the majority of those who did said they voted for President Bush. So you have people who, like Patty Casada, says, you know, we thought that we were going to, you know, doing the right thing, and that, you know, we would have President Bush as our greatest ally. She says what they found out over the course of the effort to have an investigation and during the 9/11 commission was that the president and the vice president and others in the cabinet were their greatest adversaries, which was a shock to them.
Yeah, well, okay, the 9/11 commission, I mean, it took 9 days to launch an investigation into Pearl Harbor and 7 days to investigate the JFK assassination and another 7 days to investigate the Challenger disaster. But it took 411 days to launch an investigation into 9/11, okay? But even before the investigation got underway, did the Jersey Girls and others raise objections to the format of the investigation itself?
Yes, there's some key developments. When the president signed off on finally having an investigation in mid-November of 2002 and promptly appoints Henry Kissinger, Dr. Henry Kissinger, to lead up the whole thing. And so the family members of now the formerly formed Family Steering Committee meet with Dr. Kissinger in his Manhattan office. And during that interview with Dr. Kissinger, family member, I think Lori Van Auken, asked Dr. Kissinger, you know, "We want this to be a transparent investigation, so we want to make sure that there's no conflicts of interest, that you don't have any business clients by the name of Bin Laden." And at that point, Dr. Kissinger spills coffee that he's pouring for mostly the women in the room and all over the coffee table and practically falls off the sofa, and then the next day resigns. They don't know why, but it seemed like he probably did have business clients by the name of Bin Laden. And if that's the case, that's not who you want leading up the investigation. Subsequently, you've got Lee Hamilton, who's the co-chair, vice chair, really, of the 9/11 commission. And they find out he's the guy who, I mean, he didn't want to have any subpoenas. He didn't want to have any public inquiries. He was somebody involved in the Iran-Contra scandal commission, and he said to the press that he talked with Oliver North and believed that Oliver North would never lie to him. So he also said of himself that he never goes for the jugular. So it's not helpful for the perspective of the families to have somebody who's trying to ask the tough questions, who says of themselves they never ask tough questions. They ask softball questions, which often happen during the length of the inquiry. Lee Hamilton often asks very nice questions of Mayor Giuliani and others. Then you have the other person who's Governor Keene of New Jersey, former governor, and he had an involvement in the consortium that wanted to see a pipeline across Afghanistan. So, you know, you've got this kind of you know, situation with who the key people are who are being appointed. And then there's also the director of the whole 9/11 commission, executive director, who's Philip Zelikow, who's really in the background, but he's the person who's saying yes or no to who's going to be called forth in the witness stand. And before the 9/11 commission had its first hearings in late March of 2003, there was already an outline signed by Zelikow together with another senior counsel and agreed to upon by the co-chairs of the 9/11 commission, which provided an outline of the whole report, the chapter headings and the subheadings, which is pretty prescriptive of what they thought that the report would conclude before they began doing an investigation. And it seemed that in communications that later were unearthed into 2004, that one of the kind of the assignments for Philip Zelikow was to make sure that whatever the report would conclude, that it would not embarrass the sitting president's reelection chances in the fall of 2004. And that is not the kind of mandate that the families were happy with when they learned about that in the spring and summer of 2004.
Mm. Well, I think what's refreshing about this is that there's a wider range of questions. Like today, when you talk about the 9/11 truth movement, they seem to focus by and large on the ideas that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, which, I mean, as far as my broadcast is concerned, that may be valid. Yeah. But it doesn't encompass all these other areas. I know that, for example, the questions involving Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense at the time, was not informed in a timely way about the attacks or questions about, or at least his that's what he claimed, or questions about the numerous aircraft in the skies that they were supposed to intercept the terrorist attacks, the jets that were flying astray from their normal paths, and at the same time they scheduled the same time as these attacks, the president in a schoolroom, which it seems kind of be odd that he's told we're under attack and he's still sitting there, a potential terror attack target. Or potentially. But I guess I want to ask somebody who's written a whole lot about it, and I know there's a lot of stuff you didn't get into. I mean, you just barely scratched the surface, essentially. But what struck you as being among the more compelling of these questions from the vantage point of shaking people's faith in the official narrative of 9/11 and the reliability of governments to hold people in government to account for high crimes?
Well, there's all these different people who are in key positions on the day, and their decision-making on the day just seems extremely odd, to be generous. General Eberhardt, Ralph Eberhardt, is at the kind of NORAD headquarters in Colorado. He learns about what's going on. He understands that the South Tower has now, has been hit, and the Pentagon, there's a plane headed for the Pentagon. And at that point, he announces to his staff that in his view, things have, quote, quieted down, and decides to go off on a 40-minute slow drive through a park area to another military facility. I mean, how could one in a position of authority mandated to keep the nation safe think that after the Pentagon and the two towers have been hit, that it's time to conclude things are quieting down? The person who was in charge of hijacking and you know, coordinator dealing with hijacks when they happen once in a while before this event on September 11th, 2001, happened to be off in one of the Caribbean islands, I think maybe Puerto Rico, and seemed not to have even bothered to put somebody in charge to replace them while they were on vacation. And it's like one after another. General Myers, you know, notices that there's, you know, doesn't notice that anything's going on, and no one wants to interrupt him while he's in the middle of doing a job interview for somebody. So I mean, and it just, you know, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of examples like this. And when you put it all together, you think, well, like, how could people, you know, have thought, well, we don't want to bother. Like, on the one hand, President Bush is sitting in the classroom, shouldn't disturb him because he's got these children to read this book about a goat. And on the other hand, you've got Vice President Cheney, who's being whisked away ASAP by the Secret Service, that says, you know, no questions, we're taking you to the bunker. So there's all kinds of disconnects going on throughout the day with choices people are making in key positions.
Okay, and I guess when you put them all together, I mean, you begin to think, well, I mean, maybe there's an explanation for some of it, but not all of it. I think that one of the Jersey girls, Mindy Kleinberg, I think, said that, you know, said something to that effect. I mean, one instance is an accident, maybe luck, but you can't have this much luck, or something like that.
She gave a testimony, and her testimony before the 9/11 Commission pointed out what all the historic protocols were of intercepting planes, you know, within 2 minutes of going off course of their approved course. Because, and the reason why is there an approved course? Because you have thousands and thousands of planes, commercial planes and some private planes, in the air all the time, plus a number of military planes. And you want to make sure that they stay on course, so they don't crash into another plane up in the sky. So that's why they have the protocol in place. And so when they find a plane has gone, you know, 2 miles off course, they want to know why. I mean, is there engine trouble? Is there a sick pilot? What's going on? And then they try and bring it down very quickly to the ground to sort out what's going on. But on this day, you know, four for four, the military, you know, Air Force couldn't do what their pilots, who there are pilots every month that train, you know, in every sector of the nation, not one day a month, but six times a month, to do exactly what they were supposed to do and trained to do, but failed to do on every score. So for a family member who's lost, you know, who has one less person sitting at the dining room table each day, They can't just sort of wave off that wonderment. It just sits with them, because they think if it hadn't been for people doing what they are trained to do and are proud of being able to do, this event, you know, could have been averted, they believe.
Just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and my guest is the writer Ray McGinnis, who's the author of the 2021 book Unanswered Questions: What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. Ray, you mentioned in your description of the Jersey girls a gentleman by the name of Paul Thompson, and his invaluable timeline of information coming from official stories and the incredible contradictions that resulted in the official account of 9/11. In print, it's called The Terror Timeline, Year by Year, Hour by Hour, Minute by Minute, Comprehensive Chronicle of the Road to 9/11. Talk a little bit about that timeline and its utility in directing and shaping the questions, or at least some of the questions that were submitted to the 9/11 Commission.
Yeah, so the family members, you know, the Jersey girls, Mindy Kleinberg, Kristen Breitweiser, Patty Kasaza, and Lori Van Auken, and sometimes also Monica Gabrielle, and to some extent Sally Regenhardt were also involved in getting together. They were cutting and pasting, you know, all these articles that they're finding in the Philadelphia papers and the New York papers and the papers in Connecticut and New Jersey and other, you know, national papers that they could find. And you know, they print off an article in the San Francisco Chronicle or whatever it is and put it into their physical binder. And then here was this guy, Paul Thompson, who had begun to get curious about it and ended up having over, I don't know, 5,700 or more articles. And they were all put in this timeline, each article connecting to other articles that were relevant to a specific article. And so this kind of way of being able to quickly go and look online, as well as to look at his physical book, gave them a way of being able to shape the questions that they wanted to ask each individual cabinet minister, you know, cabinet member of the George W. Bush White House, to ask different agencies, the FAA, the CIA, the FBI, and so on. And so it was an immeasurable help to them, because otherwise, you know, even for me, like looking at trying to write my book, I can go and do a Google search. I mean, I might think, well, what would the question be that I want to ask, or how do I follow up this question the families have asked? And I might search. I might even know an article that I want to find in the Chicago Tribune, but Google might not give me that article. I mean, Paul Thompson's timeline is really valuable in showing all kinds of contradictions between what people say, all kinds of disconnects that just don't add up.
Ray, what was in a nutshell, how does the number of unanswered questions correspond to the number of answered questions?
So we have 9% of the questions that the families ask, like questions and sub questions. I'd say there's over 1,000 questions that they asked the 9/11 commission to drill into. 9% were answered. 20% were touched on. I'm going to give you an example of a question that was touched on. Donald Rumsfeld was asked, "Mr. Rumsfeld, did you order planes to be scrambled to protect the Pentagon?" And he answered it in this way. He spent a long time pausing and looking at the drapes and the wallpaper and the paint and the wall and the ceilings. And then he repeated the question, "Did I ask for planes to be scrambled to intercept the jets?" And then Tom Keene, the chair of the 9/11 commission, said, "Time's up," banged the gavel, and said, "Next question." So there's a question that was asked, and that's the way it was handled at the 9/11 commission. And then you have 70% of the questions that weren't touched on at all. So numbers of, Lori Van Auken, Mindy Kleinberg, and others have, you know, told people in the Hartford Courant and other papers that they felt that what was going on throughout the commission hearings was, quote, political theater. Mm-hmm. You have five, you know, each of the 10 commissioners has 5 minutes to ask the witness on the stand, often without swearing under oath, to testify. And you will have people asking questions of the witness, a female witness perhaps, and say, you know, "Those are really lovely slacks. So that's a nice pantsuit you've got on," or "I love your hairdo." Now, if you have an hour to have a conversation, maybe you can make some kind of breaking the ice comments like that. But if you only have 5 minutes, you don't want to waste your time with those kinds of comments. And this is what the families found so frustrating over and over again, that the commissioners were throwing softball questions, complimenting people on, you know, or talking about how it must have been really hard, you know, and not even asking the questions that needed to be asked. And so a witness would be there who has all kinds of information possibly. The other thing I want to say is that you also had witnesses that came before the commission, either before the public hearings or in private, secure, behind closed doors interviews with staff from the CIA, the FBI, Pentagon, and so on. And they're coming with information. And beside them is a government minder, a senior position to them. And that person is sitting beside them, perhaps putting their foot on that person's foot, or standing behind them with their squeezing their shoulder. Or sometimes even a question is asked of that witness, and the government minder says, "I'll answer that question." And so the families complained about intimidation of witnesses with key information. And how can you expect witnesses to answer questions if they're thinking that they're going to face retribution for telling what they know?
The family members who you would think would elicit sympathy from the public, but it instead drew very critical and even dismissive comments from public figures, like Ann Coulter, for example, saying, quote, "I've never seen people enjoying their husband's death so much," or Canadian critic Jonathan Kay, an author of Among the Truthers, who said the Jersey Girls and Bob McElvain were, quote, you know, damaged survivors and effective recruiters for conspiracist movements like opposition to fluoride and vaccines. Because, quote, "the spectacle of their grief short circuits our intellectual faculties." I'm wondering what kind of an impact do you think all between the hard work and that pushback they got from all those figures, putting it into their investigation, what has it had on the families today? I mean, considering the results, I wonder if they would all do it again. What do you think about the result on their journey to justice?
I think that they would all do it again. I think that they did not expect, I mean, many of them were average people who, I mean, some of them like Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad died in the South Tower, like was not really involved in politics at all. I mean, so it just was one of these things where they were shocked at the pushback that they got in the press at times. They were grateful for people like Gail Sheehy and others that gave them the time of day and asked questions. But it was a real, kick in the face, and Ann Coulter and other comments like that. And the dismissiveness. And I guess it's troubling because there are people in the media that make a bet that if you clobber some individual or some group often enough and throw everything at the kitchen sink at them, that many people in the general public will enjoy the sport of seeing somebody demonized and dismissed. And that's discouraging when they're some of the people that have the most invested in making sure that America, in this case, would get it right to protect themselves in case of another attack in the future.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time and I'm through with my round of questions, but I advise people have a look at the book, Unanswered Questions. And you have another book coming out soon. I hope it's not quite out yet, but it's maybe a few days away, but I hope we'll get a chance to talk about it too. Thank you very much for coming on the Global Research News Hour, Ray. I really appreciate your time.
Great. Very grateful to be here. Thanks so much.
Ray McGinnis is author of Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. Ray is interested in the stories we tell, the narratives we trust, and how this shapes our world. He lives in Vancouver, Canada.
That's it for this show. Tune in for a brand new show next week. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.